Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week we have two interviews that have nothing to do with the 2016 election. The first one touches on it just a little bit, but only tangentially. First, we'll be joined by Mark Goldberg, who edits UN Dispatches and hosts the Global Dispatches podcast. And we'll talk to him about foreign policy, Russia, Syria. There's a new UN Secretary General. Then we'll be joined by Bronwyn Dickey. Bronwyn is a journalist and the author of Pitbull, The Battle Over an American Icon. And we're going to talk about dogs and media panics. But first, let's talk a little bit about this election. Shortly after the GOP convention, Donald Trump enjoyed, kind of a brief spike in the polls, and a lot of my liberal friends started to get panicky. At the time, I told them that there's so much dirt on this guy that hasn't been aired. I mean, he hasn't faced this kind of scrutiny throughout a career of being a sleazebag, and he's going to be shredded when he starts getting that kind of scrutiny, the kind of scrutiny that comes with a presidential, with a general election for a president of the United States. And I said that the Dems had a ton of Oppo research on him that they were just sitting on. By the way, it was reported this week that Donald Trump put the kibosh on his own campaign doing self-opposition research. Usually campaigns will research their own flaws, dig out their own dirt, dig up their own skeletons in the closet so that they're prepared for these things. Because Donald Trump, obviously a clinical narcissist, would not allow his campaign to do this work, all of these revelations are coming as a surprise to his staff. It must be absolute hell working for this guy. Anyway, fast forward to Friday. When I wake up, six women had accused Trump of sexual improprieties of one sort or another. Six women who used their names. I'm not counting anonymous accusers, including a girl who said under oath that he raped her when she was a teenager. By the end of the day, six had become 11. And it seems all but impossible that there won't be more. There's going to be more. Trump responded by pretty much giving us what is the most dramatic meltdown in American political history. He gave a speech last week that was billed as a response to the allegation against him, but it turned out to be this feverish mishmash of conspiracy theories and grievances. Everybody noted the anti-Semitic overtones as he kind of railed against a globalist elite that controls the media and the economy and is out to screw you. It was really, stab in the back kind of thing. It was the most amazing political speech I've ever seen. Meanwhile, Trump's setting up a very dangerous dynamic. Let me read you a little snippet from a report in the Boston Globe on Saturday. It's by Matt Visor and Tracy Yan, J-A-N. They write, and I quote, "Anger and hostility were the most overwhelming sentiments at a Trump rally in Cincinnati last week, a deep sense of frustration, an us versus them mentality, and a belief that they are part of an unstoppable and underestimated movement. Unlike many in the country, however, these hardcore Trump followers do not believe the real estate mogul's misfortunes are of his own making. They believe what Trump has told them over and over, that this election is rigged, and if he loses, it will be because of a massive conspiracy to take him down. At a time when trust in government is at a low point, Trump is actively stoking fears that a core tenet of American democracy is also in peril, that you can trust what happens at the ballot box. His supporters here say they plan to go to their local precincts to look for illegal immigrants who may attempt to vote. They are worried that Democrats will load up buses of minorities and take them to vote several times, in different areas of the city. They've heard rumors that boxes of Clinton votes are already waiting somewhere. And if Trump doesn't win, some are even openly talking about violent rebellion and assassination, as fantastical and unhinged as that may seem." This is, by the way, a news story. It's not an opinion piece. They quote Dan Boomin, a 50-year-old contractor, saying, "If she's in office, I hope we can start a coup. She should be in prison or shot. That's how I feel about it. We're going to have a revolution and take them out of office if that's what it takes. There's going to be a lot of bloodshed, but that's what it's going to take." That's what we're dealing with, folks. Make sure you vote. Now, my general rule of thumb is that, you know, 99% of these folks, or 99.9% of these folks, are more bark than bite. But that last percent, or that last tenth of a percent, is something to worry about. There have already been 106 incidents of racial or religious violence or harassment linked to Trump supporters, according to America's Voice. Meanwhile, you have the Democrats running a campaign under a concerted cyber attack, likely from Russia. It's a historically crazy election. What is that that supposed Chinese curse? I don't think it really is. May you live in interesting times. Well, that we are. Stay tuned. We'll take a quick break and then come back with Mark Goldberg. In the meantime, enjoy some wings.
When you were young and your heart was an open book, you used to say, live and let live.
You know you did.
But if this ever-changing world in which we live in makes you give in and cry, say live and let die.
Welcome back to the show. I remain Joshua Holland, and I'm really pleased to welcome Mark Goldberg to the show. Mark is the editor of UN Dispatches, and he also hosts an excellent podcast. You should all check it out. It's called Global Dispatches, and you can find both his writing and his podcast at undispatch.com. All one word, UN Dispatch. Mark, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for taking the time to speak with us. So, Antonio Guterres, a former prime minister of Portugal, will succeed Ban Ki-moon as the UN Secretary General. Can you tell us a little bit about him? What should we expect to be different under Guterres?
Sure. So Guterres's style is markedly different from that of Ban Ki-moon. Ban Ki-moon was very much a low-key diplomat. And I should say that served him well in a number of occasions. He deserves a great deal of credit for helping to keep global attention on the climate change issue and helping to achieve the Paris Climate Change Agreement. But he did that all in a kind of a low-key style. He was not the most animated or charismatic figure. Guterres, on the other hand, is a really effective communicator in a number of different languages. He electrifies when he speaks, and he's someone that I think the U.S. press in particular will gravitate towards in a way that they didn't for Ban Ki-moon. He's just a very animated and charismatic guy. He's the first real elected politician to become Secretary General, and he has that kind of politician's charm that you would expect of someone who's able to become Prime Minister of a Western European country.
And you wrote that he was a solid choice from the perspective of the United States' relationship with the UN. Why is that important?
So the U.S. has a lot of equity in the United Nations. Number one, the U.S. is the top funder of the U.N. It contributes about 25% of the regular budget of the U.N. and about 28% of the U.N. peacekeeping budget. Above that, the U.N., the United States is also, you know, the host country of the United Nations and is also one of the P5, one of the veto-wielding members of the U.N. And he, over the years, has developed a pretty close relationship with the United States, particularly during his time as head of the UN Refugee Agency. Now, not to get too deep in the weeds, but the UN Refugee Agency is funded a way a little different than the UN. The UN is funded by membership dues. Each state pays based on their GDP. The UN Refugee Agency is essentially a charity whose contributions mostly come from member states, the voluntary contributions of member states. And consistently, the United States is the largest contributor to the UN Refugee Agency, and Guterres was an effective fundraiser for the agency in the United States, appealing to both the Bush administration and also the Obama administration. You know, he came to office as head of the UN Refugee Agency during the Bush administration, so they must have approved him, even though, you know, he's a socialist.
Ah, he's a socialist.
Yes.
You know, the U.S., famously, the public opinion of the UN is lower than in most countries, I think it's fair to say. It'll be interesting to see if his charisma does anything to change that.
Yeah, I mean, Kofi Annan also was a charismatic figure, a smooth talker, gave great speeches, but ended up being demonized by Republicans in the United States over his opposition to the U.S. war in Iraq. And so it'll be interesting to see the extent to which certain political sectors in the USA try to do the same to Guterres, because, you know, he will emerge as something of a star, I think. You know, he will be more well-known around the U.S. than Ban Ki-moon because of his more outspoken style. And so it'll be interesting to see politically whether or not that earns him any flack from Republicans. You know, and so far, he does have good relationships with Republicans. I mean, he, as I said earlier, it was the Bush administration that acceded to him being head of the UN Refugee Agency. He is a reformer in the agency. He cut budgets and also increased output. And so there's a lot for him to like, and he was clearly a favorite choice of the Obama administration.
He's coming in at a time when there are a number of garbage fires burning out of control. I want to ask you a little bit about Syria. A lot of the political debate here at home begins with the premise that it is a solvable problem if only we, and that is either the U.S. or the international community more broadly, get the right policy in place. And I'm not sure I agree with that assumption. I certainly want it to be true, but there's a concept in multilateral conflict resolution called ripeness. And the idea is that it's all but impossible to resolve a conflict for external actors to resolve a conflict until the combatants are exhausted. That's another term used in the literature, exhausted, mm-hmm. and determine that continuing to fight is unlikely to allow them to achieve their objectives, be they political or otherwise. It seems like the Assad regime believes it can defeat its opponents militarily, especially with Russian backing. The rebels are literally fighting for their lives. Is it possible that bringing about a political settlement is simply not possible at this time? Is it possible that there is no good policy, or that there is no good policy beyond mitigating the human rights catastrophe?
So there is a potential policy that could work. I mean, the times that we've seen modicum of progress on Syria is when the Security Council, namely the USA and Russia, have agreed to a specific course of action. We saw this 2 years ago around the removal of most of Syria's chemical weapons, which was done through an act of the Security Council when the US and Russia agreed. We saw, you know, there was limited humanitarian assistance when the U.S. and Russia agrees. But at this point, I mean, there is no prospect of a negotiated solution to this settlement until the regional actors are all working off the same playbook. And right now, the interests of the United States and Iran are, pardon me, of Russia and Iran versus the United States and other allies are just so too diametrically opposed that the idea of imposing a solution from the outside, like you saw, for example, happen in the Dayton Accords, which is a good example of 1995, which ended the Balkan conflict, of how an externally imposed political solution can actually stop a war. So that can happen, but the interests are not yet sufficiently aligned to make it so.
I've written in the past about peacemaking in Angola, right? That was a civil war that dragged on for three decades. There were different groups of combatants. They were all backed by different foreign powers. And there were various peace agreements that failed because the deals didn't win the buy-in of all of these disparate actors. Here in Syria, we have like 13 different armed groups, I believe, 12 or 13. You have more countries intervening on one side or the other than was true in Angola. How does the abundance of actors complicate peacemaking efforts? And is everybody at the table?
So that's been one of the key challenges so far in what in UN terms is called the Geneva process, which is this idea that you can get the actors on the ground around a table to negotiate local solutions. Two of the key problems that have emerged from this Geneva process, which currently is all but dead. The first is, who are the rebels that you are going to negotiate with? And two, how do you define who is an acceptable rebel and who is a quote terrorist? And that latter question has been a key sticking point because, the agreement that was reached in Geneva over a year ago, permitted the U.S. and Russia to work together to go after the terrorists, the ISIS and the al-Nusra Front. The Russians used an expanded definition of who is a terrorist to bomb the hell out of Aleppo. And so that's been just a key sticking point. But I'm glad you brought up Angola, because to take this back to Antonio Guterres, he came to political power. Angola is a Portuguese, a former Portuguese colony. And his real political awakening happened in the 1974 Carnation Revolution in Portugal, which was inspired by soldiers who were committing a coup against having to go fight in these forgotten and long lost colonial wars.
That's interesting. So that was when was
Not
he when, to, when was he a prime minister?
So he was a prime minister from 1995 to 2005 and was the prime minister when Portugal decriminalized and legalized drugs, actually.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. And a sort of, I know you guys have a left-leaning audience. He was also head of the Socialist International, which is to an American audience, probably more sinister than it sounds. It's basically a collection of left of center social democratic parties, kind of mainstream parties like the Labour Party in Israel or the NDP party in Canada, that all kind of meet a few times a year in conventions to probably have arguments about socialism.
I want to get back a little bit to the topic of refugees. The last time we looked at this subject, the donor community, as it is known, wasn't nearly up to the task of dealing with what I believe is the largest refugee crisis since World War II.
Yes.
Has that changed? Are we making progress?
The progress is not keeping pace with the number of refugees and displaced that are being generated each and every day. I mean, Syria is the largest driver, but there are other conflicts like in South Sudan, which now tops a million displaced. In Afghanistan, which is consistently the number two driver of refugees after Syria, and in Eritrea, which is an authoritarian government in the Horn of Africa that thousands upon thousands of people are fleeing each month. And so, no, we're not making enough progress. The needs outstrip the funds available. However, we saw a modicum of progress, I should say, at the UN General Assembly last month in New York. The United States President, Obama held a summit on refugees, and it was what they call a pay-to-play summit. So anyone who wanted to speak at the summit had to bring a specific commitment to the table that they were going to do to either help fund refugee relief Or if they're a refugee host country like Jordan or Turkey, specific policies they would enact to make life easier for refugees. So, for example, Jordan at the meeting announced that it would open up more school spots for refugee children. Turkey said that it would issue more permits for Syrian refugees to actually work in Turkey. So things like that. But to get back to your original question is no, we're not making enough progress. I mean, this is the largest refugee crisis since World War II. Some 60 million people are displaced, including some 40 million displaced internally. And we're just not the trend in a lot of European countries also is towards erecting more barriers and not towards doing all they can and living up to what they agreed to do in the 1952 Refugee Convention.
And I would add that this process has always been dogged by a mismatch between commitments, right? Countries come in and they say, oh, we'll give this and that, and then following through with the actual funds when it comes time to write that check. That's a problem that has always dogged this process. If you're just tuning in, this is Politics and Reality Radio, and I'm speaking with Mark Goldberg from UN Dispatches, also the host of Global Dispatches, a podcast which you can find at UN, what is it?
You can find it at globaldispatchespodcast.com.
Globaldispatchespodcast.com.
We keep it simple.
Okay, so let me switch insights again, switch topics again.
Yeah.
I want to pivot a little bit to U.S.-Russian relations. It's a big topic in the news today. It seems that both the U.S. and Russia, but especially Russia, are ratcheting up the rhetorical hostilities. I'm seeing people worrying about war breaking out, which seems extremely unlikely to me. This week, or perhaps it was late last week, U.S. intelligence officially accused Russia of hacking the DNC and trying to intervene in our election. Sir John Sawyer, the former head of MI6, said this week that the balance of power had shifted globally as Russia rebuilt its military, and he says we're in a notably dangerous situation because the West hasn't acknowledged that fact. What do you make of all of this stuff that's happening between the United States and Russia today?
So from a UN perspective, I'm glad that you brought up John Sawyer. He used to be the U.S., the U.K. ambassador to the U.N. I mean, we're seeing a hardening of positions on some key issues like Syria. I mean, we talked earlier, but there is no prospect of a negotiated solution to this crisis absent some coming together of the United States and Russia. I mean, the United States and Russia, we're not going to go to war. I mean, we've moved past that. However, this sort of emerging new Cold War is really sort of rearing its ugly head and manifesting itself in really dangerous ways on the ground, particularly in the Middle East, but elsewhere as well, like in the Ukraine. You know, with a new administration coming, there is the prospect for a potential other reset. Although, I mean, chances are, I mean, you know, people that Hillary listens to, and frankly, you know, Obama himself, are fed up with Putin, and there's really, you know, no other way around it.
Do you think we're going to see a kind of low-level cyber warfare become the new normal in U.S. relations? Is there a new kind of Cold War that we could be approaching?
So the U.S. has, in the past, conducted offensive cyber warfare attacks. If you'll recall, after the Sony hack, which was tied to North Korea, the U.S. launched like a DDS, distributed denial of service attack, basically shut down North Korean internet for a while. You know, I kind of look at these things almost from like a human rights perspective, where, you know, the internet and is such like a global common at this point that anything that disrupts it, the free flow of information, is really, I think, an affront to me personally, because I kind of live on the internet. But, you know, so I would hate to see any of these retaliatory measures have collateral damage outside their specific intended targets inside, say, you know, Russian intelligence. But it is sort of a brave new world, and there are really no, you know, laws of cyber war. Like, we have international humanitarian law that's been built up since World War II, saying, you know, the circumstances under which you can, you know, bomb a munitions factory that's maybe near a school. or who is a combatant, who is not a combatant, or under what circumstances can you, you know, launch a war. These are now common parts of international law. We have not yet built up the same kind of legal framework or normative framework around cyber war. So I worry that this thing can spiral out of control really quickly.
That's a really interesting insight. And it was reported today that a Russian ship may have cut the, I don't know the exact technical issues, but have cut a key cable providing internet service to Syria. Any insights into why Trump's so popular in Russia, or why Putin and his allies would want to promote his candidacy? What's that about? What's going on?
Well, I think they have that same sort of authoritarian worldview. And frankly, you know, if I was Putin, I'd be rooting for Trump. I mean, he frankly has outwardly praised praised Putin. But beyond that, you know, in some of the key issues where the USA and Russia are at loggerheads, are frankly issues that I think Hillary Clinton cares deeply about, like the plight of Syrians or the territorial integrity of the Ukraine, is something that probably Trump couldn't care less about, or at least has not demonstrated a significant amount of interest in. And so from Russia's perspective, I mean, a Trump victory would probably signal an American retreat from the world, which would allow Russia the opportunity and the potential to become a global leader that I think Putin aspires it to be.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think that there's a flip side, too, which is that, I think a Trump presidency could isolate the United States and the international community in much the same way as Putin has isolated Russia. If we elect Trump, there's not much we can say about his attacks on the press, his authoritarianism, his bigotry against gays and lesbians, etc. Trump would do more to hurt us, to hurt our credibility than, than Putin can. Mark Goldberg, I believe we are out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks, Josh.
Folks, we'll take a quick break and then switch gears in a big way when we're joined by Bronwyn Dickey to discuss her book, Pitbull, The Battle Over an American Icon. My own goofy pit bulls will be listening with keen interest. Stay tuned.
You know my girl now. Yeah. You know my girl just called me up. And she woke me from my sleep. You should have heard the things she said. You know she heard.
You need all the friends you can get, I'm telling you.
I'm gonna buy me a dog. My girl, no love, no how.
Don't ruin my song. It's
the only song I
have. Ruined, but it
was right. Where's the verse? She used to bring me my newspaper.
You don't even know where it's at.
She knew where it was at. She used to keep me so. That. I'm gonna buy me a dog.
You can teach a dog to do that. You can only train elephants.
Cause I need a friend now.
I need a friend now. Yeah.
I'm gonna buy me a dog.
A dog here over Fido Spot.
My girl, I'm gonna let me know how.
1, 2, 3, 4.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Hike!
Welcome back. I'm Joshua Holland. This is Politics and Reality Radio. And I'm joined now by Bronwyn Dickey, who's written a terrifically informative book. It's called Pitbull, The Battle Over an American Icon. Welcome to the show, Bronwyn.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for taking the time to speak with me about this. This is a subject dear to my heart. A lot of people believe pit bulls are uniquely dangerous. There are a lot of myths out there that they're especially aggressive, that they have jaws with some magical locking mechanism. Some people think they have the bite force of a great white shark. It's all nonsense, as we'll see during this segment. What they are, though, is the breed that is most likely to be abused and sometimes killed. They're the breed most likely to be abandoned, to end up in shelters, and the most likely to be put down in shelters. when did pit bulls become monsters in our popular imagination? They didn't always have this image.
No. They've always, you know, it's kind of interesting. There have always been people who didn't like them. There have always been people who kind of looked down their nose at them, certainly, because by and large, these were always dogs of working class people. But in the early part of the 20th century, the late 19th century, the early 20th century, the Depression, certainly, they were really seen as the all-American dog. Kind of the dog with the patch over his eye was kind of quintessentially American in every way.
Petey from the Little Rascals.
Right? But not only Petey, there were so many pit bulls in silent film, in Hollywood, pit bulls used in advertising, just as this kind of this symbol of rugged Americanism, the kind of pull yourself up by your bootstraps, Horatio Alger kind of dog. And so they had this very illustrious history back then, very, very Teddy Roosevelt, if you recall his strenuous life speech. They were very popular mascots, too. And then kind of in the 1970s, there was this very well-intentioned effort by the humane movement, which was, you know, just starting to do major legislative stuff to eradicate what was left of the crime of illegal dogfighting. Which was kind of moribund at that time. It was dwindling away, but the remnants of it that were still there were very hard to wipe out. So there was this push to make dogfighting a front page issue that voters would support legislation on. And in doing that, there was so much speculation about these dogs rather than the people who abused them that it got kind of out of control. Lots of people were saying completely unscientific and very sensationalistic things about the dogs being machines, killing machines, predators, you know, super kind of ultra killing machines, basically. And that really kind of became its own self-fulfilling prophecy. Instead of people shying away from the dogs, I mean, lots of, you know, pet owners certainly did, but then they became more appealing to people who probably shouldn't have had them. And so it became this cycle. And then there was this big media explosion in the 1980s about pit bulls being the ultimate urban problem.
Have there been other breeds that played that role, the role of the boogeyman, at different times in our history?
Oh, absolutely. We've done this for a really long time. Dog panics have cycled through our culture for hundreds of years. And the most kind of extreme ones started really in the late 19th century. In 1877, for instance, there was a massive panic in New York City over fluffy white Spitz dogs, which then included white Pomeranians. They were very popular as ladies' pets at that time, and there were just tons of them. So when bite reports were examined, they saw that most bites were coming from Spitz dogs, and they thought that perhaps the dogs were most susceptible to rabies or uniquely susceptible to rabies. So there were editorials in the New York Times calling the Spitz venomous, saying that the dogs needed to be eradicated. And that started a spree of persecution against these dogs where they were clubbed, drowned, beaten in the street.
Jesus.
Yeah, it was really ugly. It was a complete panic. And that was because we really didn't know how rabies was transmitted. And so when you have this vacuum, you know, where there's fear, you know, and a knowledge vacuum, people will fill that in with all kinds of things. So that there was that. There was also a big panic in the late 19th century about bloodhounds. What was in there was the Cuban bloodhound, a very large mastiff that was associated with slave owners and slave catching. We've done this to, quote, German police dogs or German shepherds. There was a whole thing in the 1920s where there were editorials about these dogs are bred from wolves. They cannot exist in civilized society, equating them with mobsters, very much like the pit bull narrative we see now. And then you had Dobermans in the 1950s and 60s and Rottweilers in the 90s. So we do this all the time. But usually it's really more about people kind of hashing out their issues with other social groups and using a proxy for it rather than it says anything about actual dog behavior.
Before the break, I said that I'd be recording this segment with my two pit bulls. They're not actually pit bulls. They're pit bull type dogs.
Right.
Daisy, I know, is half American pit bull terrier and half boxer. Oscar is a classic American pound dog. He's a total mutt. My understanding is that maybe half of the dogs in the United States are purebreds. And I saw a study that found that personnel at animal shelters, these are experts, have a huge error rate as far as identifying breeds. They basically get it right about as often as they get it wrong, and they're professionals. Does misidentification play a role in this common belief that pit bulls are a menace?
Oh, absolutely. As you said, you know, we don't know exactly how many of the dogs are how many dogs in America are purebred or not, but most people seem to say that the majority of American dogs are not purebred. They're mixed breeds, and they're not just, you know, half and half. They're not like, you know, a Rottweiler lab mix. They are actually mix upon mix upon mix. They're multi-generational mixes. But we have this very like brand conscious framework that's a holdover from the Victorian dog show kind of hype that started a lot of this. So we kind of think of dogs as being pure breeds even when they're not, or if they're not pure, they must be a combination of two pure breeds. So with these particular dogs, it becomes really problematic because even in there are four, pit bull is not one breed. There are four pedigreed breeds that are considered pit bulls, kind of like, you know, there's not just one type of hound. There are many types of hounds. So you have your American Pit Bull Terrier, which was kind of your core original breed. You have your American Staffordshire Terrier, which is its AKC counterpart. You have your Staffordshire Bull Terrier, which is kind of like a miniature version, and that's also an AKC dog, confirmation dog. And then you have a newer breed called the American Bully, which are the dogs with the much larger heads, and they're kind of built like little sumo wrestlers or hippos. They're often blue and white. So there are four pedigreed breeds, and then all these other dogs, kind of dogs not otherwise specified, get lumped into the category of pit bull when people don't know what else to call them. So as you say, you know, correctly, that study, there are a growing body of studies now confirming those results that even animal professionals, when they're looking at mixed breed dogs and trying to ascertain which breeds are likely to be in the DNA soup, they come up with answers that don't show up in the dog's DNA reports at all. And what's even more interesting about that is that usually the professionals don't agree with each other as to what labels should be affixed to which dogs. You know, one person will say, pointer golden retriever mix, and another person will say, you know, setter hound something mix. I mean, you know, it just doesn't, and they can be looking at the exact same dog. So it's this incredibly subjective, like ink blot thing that we're doing, and yet we affix this label to dogs that, you know, at its largest, if you open it way up, I mean, you could be talking about a quarter of the dog population if you're talking about any dog with a kind of large head and a short coat. So I think at one point, and I write about this in the book, the AKC had complained that 27 breeds had been misidentified as pit bulls during the kind of media hype of the 1980s. So, you know, it makes these things really hard. When you read stories about a, quote, pit bull that did something awful, you know, that could just be a mixed breed dog that someone decided, maybe it had a brindle coat, therefore it must be a pit bull.
And you end up with a vicious cycle. The media hype these monstrous dogs, and then people who witness a dog attack say, oh, it was a pit bull.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. Because it really has become this catch-all, almost meaningless term. And it completely bungles all statistics that we have. I mean, people who really want to see these dogs eradicated and exterminated, they'll trot out any number of bite statistics saying, well, oh, look, pit bulls are at the top. But no one has ever made any independent verification to find out what those dogs actually were. Same goes with medical statistics. So it just becomes really problematic, and it's such an inaccurate way of looking at things. But people are determined to do it, even when they know better.
I would note that my mother has my canine brother Bandit. She, for some reason, she did a genetic test on him. She wanted to find out what he was. He is a pit bull type dog. He looks very pit bullish, but he had 11 different breeds in him.
Right, exactly, right? It's breed and breed, yeah.
And they included things like, I think he had a small amount of poodle in him and a little bit of like little yappy dogs. He's a huge 80-pound dog, but he had a very interesting melange of breeds came back. So you mentioned the people who want to eradicate these dogs. They always cite these data compiled by the CDC that show that pit bulls and Rottweilers were responsible for a disproportionate share of serious canine attacks. In addition to misidentification, aren't we missing the context here? I mean, it seems to me that there's a parallel. And this is always very touchy to get into, but, you know, it is a statistical reality that African-American males are prosecuted for crimes at a disproportionate rate. If you say that that's because they are genetically predisposed to commit crimes, we consider that a racist approach. We say, well, you're not looking at the larger context of discrimination in the criminal justice system, poverty, the interaction between poverty and crime, et cetera, et cetera. Isn't the same thing going on here? I mean, don't we know what risk factors there are for serious dog attacks?
Yes. And I think it's an interesting, you know, parallel for a lot of reasons. But yeah, when you look at these things, for instance, the instances of dog bite related fatalities, which are incredibly rare. But yeah, those CDC studies that you mentioned seem to put pit bulls, quote, pit bulls, you know, all lumped together as one breed, and Rottweilers as being at the top of the list. In some of those years, Rottweilers overtook pit bulls, but, you know, whatever. Yet when I actually interviewed the epidemiologist who had done those studies, he was very adamant that now, knowing what he knows now, he thinks about that data in a very different way. There was lots of disagreement about as to which dogs did which things, you know, different media reporting different types of dogs involved in incidents. And also, as you say, the context was really stripped out. If you only look at the numbers, then you aren't seeing all this other context. You aren't seeing, you know, where the dogs lived, if they were under constant stress, do they live in very deprived areas? You know, did the owner or someone in the caring for the dog have a history of violence? Who was the target? Like all these things that we look at when we're, say, looking at human violence, because we understand that as human beings, there's so much more to us than just our genes. Our genes are definitely an important part of who we are, but they aren't everything. And there's a lot of contextual stuff that goes into why we do what we do. So when we look at something like human violence with our own species, we can understand there are layers. But with dogs, I think one of the things that we've done with them traditionally, and we've done this for a really long time, is we're so comfortable with this idea that they are like products on an assembly line that we created. that we think about them almost like, you know, cars or something, or blenders, or some kind of inanimate object. And we forget that, you know, they have co-evolved with us for 35,000 years. They are very complex, and they've specifically evolved to pay attention and to respond and react to what we are doing all the time. So if you're just looking at the dog and its behavior, if you're looking at the dog in some kind of vacuum, you're really not going to find anything of value there. You have to look at the relationship between the dog and its human, and the history between the dog and its human. And that's where the interesting info is. So yeah, I think on a certain level, you're right. We can accept that there's context when it's our species, but we have a really hard time understanding that there's context when it comes to the species that lives most closely with us.
It's a really fundamentally reductionist way of looking at it, because we know that the vast majority of serious dog bites are, for example, perpetrated by unneutered males. And frequently they're dogs that were poorly socialized, kept in isolation. Mm-hmm. Being tied up all the time is a risk factor for violence within dogs. And one thing that I find really interesting is that you can abuse a dog, you can do a poor job socializing them, you can keep them tied up, and in most cases, they're not going to commit violence against people. The evolutionary instincts among these animals is really strong.
Absolutely, so, yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about breed-specific legislation. That is, local laws banning the ownership of certain breeds. What is the primary problem with these laws?
Oh, I mean, where does one even begin? This was a trend that started, technically it started back in 1877 with the Spitz. The Spitz was the first dog to be banned in America. It was banned in Long Branch, New Jersey. But for most of the 20th century, this was not an approach that people were interested in. And then when the pit bull panic exploded in the media in the 1980s, there started to be this kind of clamoring for banning the dogs from communities, people saying they did not belong in civilized society. Of course, they were taking the short view and not the long view. If they had looked at things historically, they would see, oh, you know, these panics are cyclical. The dogs that kind of top the list in terms of scary incidents, that's cyclical. It's almost like this kind of sad, tragic game of musical chairs that we just put dogs into. But you know, when people get scared, they kind of retract and their view gets narrower. And so people really thought that banning the dogs and eradicating them from communities was the way to go. So in 1989, Denver and Miami both banned the dogs. In 1991, the UK banned pit bulls, and that was really interesting. That was in response to a Rottweiler panic, yet the Rottweiler was protected by kind of fancy breed clubs, whereas it was easier to kind of persecute and punish people who owned pit bulls because they were at the lower end of the economic spectrum. And then you saw kind of a tidal wave across Europe of European countries wanting to ban the dogs, saying they were an urban menace, et cetera. And the biggest problem with these laws, one, is that they're so incredibly short-sighted. But two, they just don't work. We now have studies from, I think, 7 or 8 different countries now, from the UK, from Belgium, from the Netherlands, from Spain, from Germany, from Italy, from parts of Canada, that show when you divert animal control resources toward rounding dogs up that just have a certain appearance, those resources aren't going toward, you know, dealing with dogs that are actually causing problems. It's like this weird version of Minority Report that just simply doesn't work. And so a lot of times you'll see in a community, you'll see when a significant number of dogs are rounded up and removed, you'll see an initial drop in bites because you've taken a number of dogs out of the community, and then the bites start climbing right back up. And oftentimes they will exceed what they were originally because you haven't dealt with the underlying problems. Also, it tends to, and I think this can't really be discounted, it's really a way of persecuting, we kind of talk about these things as though they're persecuting the dog, but you're really persecuting a group of people. And you're usually persecuting a group of people that does not have the resources to fight back. And that's why these laws usually get passed. So, you know, we have so much more science than we had back in 1989 when these things became popular. And we know that if you pass comprehensive legislation that is community-based, that supports pet owners in making healthy decisions for their pets, and that holds everybody to a high standard, that, you know, the public is so much safer and the community is so much better off. But people, you know, it's like a kind of easy political fix. They want to identify a scary other and, you know, build a wall.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, the problem, the fundamental problem is that they focus on the dog when it's almost always a human ownership problem that, yes, that leads to problematic dogs. So, you know, we're trying to deal with it by taking good dogs away from good owners, and that's not going to help anything. When I lived in San Francisco, they had these dog courts, and a friend of mine had a dog who nipped this bicycle rider. He had a bicycle issue. Mm-hmm. And so we went to court and I went as a witness, and it was remarkable how it was very much like a human judicial process, right? Mm. I was a witness for this dog. I was a character witness, and they found that it's very effective. They find what they do is they'll do things. They'll sentence somebody to reinforce their fence, things like that. Mm. You know, and order them to keep the dog on a leash or this or that, order them not to let them off leash at dog parks rather than destroying them or taking away an entire breed. And it is specific to the dog. What about this idea that they were bred for fighting and are therefore more aggressive than other breeds?
Yeah, it's so interesting how that idea endures when it doesn't for other dogs. You know, as I was researching the book, you know, there's 7 years of research that went into this book. And one of the interesting things was, and one of the heartbreaking things was learning how many horrible uses various types of dogs have been put to over the years. I mean, one of the kind of most unfair and cruel things we've done to dogs is use them in really terrible ways, not just against each other, as in dog fighting, but using them against people. You know, the German Shepherd was never a, quote, herding dog. It was developed in 1899 specifically to, I don't want to use the word attack, but let's say subdue humans, but go after humans. Same with the Doberman. So, you know, we can kind of accept with those dogs that we've moved on. You know, Rhodesian Ridgebacks don't bay lions anymore. Dachshunds don't go after badgers anymore. There are all these, you know, we're fine understanding that we live in a pet culture and that, you know, working dogs are basically what we have. The dogs of today are these kind of remnants of their historical working selves. But when it comes to pit bulls, like, that just completely goes out the window. And people are like, if they ever had a historically rough purpose, then all of these dogs must be bad. It's like saying, well, Australia was once a penal colony, therefore all Australians are criminals. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. The Boxer was once a fighting dog. The Shar Pei was once known as the Chinese fighting dog. And they don't carry the burden that pit bulls do. And so I think it's really important to realize that even when these dogs were used for that, it was always a very small percentage. Even the people that were engaged in this crime estimated that no more than 10% of pit bulls were actually matched in fights, because fighting is a very extreme thing to breed for. It's not something. It's not like pointing or retrieving something that's really advantageous to the dog, that helps it secure food and, you know, feed itself. You know, fighting. Dogs are social animals. A dog that fights other dogs does not last very long. So it's a very extreme thing to breed for. And there's a very high washout rate. There's a very low success rate. So, I mean, the idea that somehow all pit bulls of today, most of whom are come from accidental litters or come from people's backyards or are confirmation dogs or pet dogs, the idea that all these dogs are somehow tainted because there was this core of, you know, fighting dogs 200 years ago just makes absolutely no sense.
You know, and they were also used for herding and other purposes. I mean, it's crazy. The other thing, it's a touchy subject, but if you go to any predominantly African-American or Latino community in the U.S., you will find that pit bull dog type dogs are the most popular. You know, racism, old-fashioned human racism definitely plays a role in the demonization of these dogs, if you ask me. One final thing that I'll ask you is, I wrote about this a few years ago in Salon, and I'm mostly a political writer. I got so much nasty hate mail for that. It was on par with writing about immigrant rights or feminism. I was just bombarded with hate email.
From people who hated the dogs?
Yeah. And I think it was because it challenged their conception of these dogs.
Mm-hmm.
And that really bothered them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I've certainly, you know, unfortunately, experienced a fair amount of that. And it's become pretty disruptive while I was out promoting the book these past couple of months. About a couple of months before the book actually came out, when a few maybe news articles or reviews started to come out about it, I started getting bombed with messages from anonymous Facebook pages. And they said that they wanted to destroy me, and they called me every kind of horrible name you can imagine. They ridiculed my dead father.
What is wrong with people?
They posted photos of my house online. And at one point, someone actually came to a reading and was so disruptive, you know, his questions were so disruptive that he was asked to leave, and he wouldn't. And so the store owner had to call the cops, and I had to leave through the rear exit with a police escort. It was really strange. So my publisher then had to get security for my readings. I mean, it was just, I think, 6 or 7 stores that I read at, bookstores, received hate mail or were trolled online. And it gave this illusion that there's this like army of people that feels this way. But in reality, I had been like looking at this stuff for a really long time, and I knew that it's actually a really, really tiny but highly obsessive and motivated group of people who spend all their time online, have many aliases, and this is their thing. They feel aggrieved in some way, and they want to kind of weaponize that grief against other people. And I think some of them aren't even really aggrieved. They just, you know, this is their issue. They were kind of looking for something to hate, and this became something to hate for them. But yeah, it's been a really challenging thing to write about, because people have such strong feelings. They assume that if you're exploring one angle, you must be completely shut off to the other angle. You know, if you're exploring media hype and sensationalism around pit bulls or you know, what we think we know and don't really know, then you must not care about the people who have been injured. And that, in my case, that could absolutely not be further from the truth. I have, you know, tremendous sympathy for people who've been injured by any type of dog, and I think we need stronger laws to help those people have recourse. But, you know, no one really wants to hear that when they're kind of dug into one side of an issue. But yeah, it's a really, really interesting thing. It's very much like the anti-vaccination movement, I think, and very much like some of these other kind of fringe fringe groups, the Sandy Hook truther kind of thing. It's kind of an offshoot of trutherism that attracts a really small but very motivated and often frightening group of people.
I never would have guessed that I would have gotten that reaction for that article.
No, Bronwyn, you should have gotten in touch with me. I would have told you.
I believe we are out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really do appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me. This is fun.
Folks, Bronwyn's book is called Pitbull, The Battle Over an American Icon. I strongly suggest that you get yourself a copy so that you can argue with your crazy Pitbull truther friends. I'd also like to thank Mark Goldberg. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can subscribe to the show at iTunes or Podbean or SoundCloud or wherever else you can find it. You can also send an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. I'd like to thank Digby and Crooks and Liars for allowing me to park the show over at their joints. And of course, I'd like to thank all of you good people for tuning in. Have a terrific week.